Good afternoon, Sonoma County and the world. The time is 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS, Cows Radio. Broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. Bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cows Community Radio thanks Many Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Many Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Many Rivers carries fine loose-leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Many Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. You can phone them at 707-829-8871 or visit them on the web at www.miniriversbooks.com. Cows Radio would like to thank June Ahern, author of The Consumer Guide, The Timeless Counselor, The Best Guide to Successful Psychic Reading, for her generous support. June has also authored the novels The Sky in June and City of Redemption. These books are available through JuneAhern.com or Amazon. As a life coach, June has also taught many people to manifest their visions to fulfillment. For more information, please visit JuneAhern.com. Cows Community Radio is membership supported. Everyone who works at the station does so on a volunteer basis, but there are real operating costs to keep this station on the air. We also have a number of exciting projects for the new year, including moving our antenna from the ridge west of Occidental to the ridges between Sebastopol and Occidental so that we can better serve the West Sonoma County area and reach downtown Sebastopol. So we're excited about these projects, but we need your support. Cows has been going through exciting changes this year. We have a whole new set of programmers. We have a whole new set of underwriters sponsoring our work, and we're looking for additional support from the community and from our listeners. So please go to www.kows.fm and find out how you can participate in this exciting project so that Cows can fulfill its mission of being the heart of West Sonoma County. This week, our guest by telephone on The Mystical Positivist is Dr. Charles Garfield. Charles Garfield, Ph.D., is the founder of Shanti and Shanti National Training Institute. He is a clinical professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California Medical School and a former board member of the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco. He has also published 10 books, including Sometimes My Heart Goes Numb, Love and Caregiving in a Time of AIDS, Psychosocial Care of the Dying Patient, and Stress and Survival, the Emotional Realities of Life-Threatening Illnesses. We'll get started with that conversation after a short musical break. During the break, you'll be listening to a track called Two Studies on Ancient Greek Scales by Harry Parch. This is arranged by Ben Johnson, and this is from the CD Kronos Quartet, Early Music. We'll be right back. This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick, the Mystical Positivist. Joining me in the studio today is my co-host, Dr. Robert Schmidt, the director of Tayu Meditation Center and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol.
Awesome to be here as ever.
This week, our guest by telephone is Dr. Charles Garfield. Dr. Charles Garfield has been recognized internationally as the founder of Shanti, a widely acclaimed volunteer organization, and the Shanti National Training Institute. For over 35 years, he has pioneered the development of service-oriented volunteer organizations and the training of volunteers in a wide variety of applications. For his work with Shanti and for originating the Shanti model of peer support, Garfield was named National Activist of the Year, one of America's highest awards to individuals making voluntary contributions in public service. He has also received recognition by cities and organizations large and small, including a Mayor's Day in his honor in San Francisco and many others. Dr. Garfield serves as clinical professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California School of Medicine at San Francisco. A fellow of the American Psychological Association, he is currently a visiting scholar at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Charles Garfield is the co-author of Training Volunteers for Community Service, the step-by-step guide of the Shanti National Training Institute. He is also the author of Sometimes My Heart Goes Numb, Love and Caregiving in a Time of AIDS. While on the faculty of the Cancer Research Institute at UCSF, he was one of the early contributors to the burgeoning field of psychosocial oncology. Two of his books, Stress and Survival, The Emotional Realities of Life-Threatening Illnesses, and Psychosocial Care of the Dying Patient, have been used as texts in many medical and nursing schools. Charles Garfield began his career in computer science after receiving two graduate degrees in mathematics from Adelphi University, as well as induction into Pi Mu Epsilon, the National Mathematics Honorary Society, and later the Adelphi University Alumni Academy of Distinction. Dr. Garfield worked as a computer analyst on Apollo 11, our first lunar landing. It was as a member of the team that sent the first two astronauts to the moon that he learned how mission-driven teams can band together to accomplish extraordinary results. He then continued his education, earning a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of California at Berkeley, prior to publishing 10 books, including the highly regarded Peak Performance Trilogy on High-Achieving Individuals, Teams, and Organizations, Second to None, Peak Performers and Peak Performance. His honorary speeches include Clinton White House Conference, U.S. Olympic Committee, and Head Coaches of Olympic Sports, and the leadership of Oklahoma City following the tragic bombing of the federal building. Charles Garfield was an at-large member of the Board of Governors and is currently an instructor at the C.G. Young Institute of San Francisco. He serves on the editorial board of Greater Good, a national magazine from the University of California, Berkeley's Center of Science and the Greater Good. He is also a founding member of the Meta Institute, formerly known as Zen Hospice, end-of-life counselor training program. Charles Garfield, welcome to The Mystical Positivist.
Well, thank you. Thank you for all that introduction.
Well, it's I'm going to go ahead and ask you our question that we always ask our guests to start these interviews off. And just listening to the list of the wide range of accomplishments that you've created in your life, it just only underscores how interesting this question is or can be, which is basically we want you to tell us something about or anything about early experiences in childhood or adolescence that perhaps in retrospect could be seen as leading to the directions that you went with your career or careers in your life.
I think there are probably two early experiences that were most powerful. and it took many years to figure them out, to understand the significance. One, early on, at the age of 9, I had a series of what one might call minor mystical experiences, the kind that it turns out children have rather regularly but never talk about. In my case, I was in all of these instances, and there were about 4 of them. I was sitting outside. It was late in the evening. It was before dinner. It was already dark. And the moon came down, and I had this intimate sense of the basic all-rightness of the universe, this strong sense that a 9-year-old might have, that I belonged in the universe, that I was safe in the universe, that all would be well. Those experiences stayed with me and still stay with me now, all these decades later, as a kind of basic assurance that I have a connection to something greater than myself, that we all have a connection to something greater than ourselves. The other, call it a tributary to my spiritual development, happened in what might be called service. It might be called volunteer work. It might be called karma yoga in the Hindu tradition. It's in essence, it's the strong sense that one can connect with other human beings and must connect with other human beings in the spirit of service. And this always seemed to be common sense to me. Not so much because I grew up with it in my family, although there was some of that awareness in my family, but it just seemed that I was here in this world to contribute to the welfare of other human beings. And from the time of adolescence on, that just seemed to be a very clear imperative in my life.
Interesting. Would you make any linkage between these two, the second point, this sense of service through connection with others to those set of 4 experiences, mystical experiences that you mentioned? Well, you know, I had similar sorts of things, actually roughly about the same age, and I'm just wondering if there was any linkage between those two that you would identify.
Yeah, that I could identify now, but certainly not for many years. What I would say would be with the early mystical experiences at the age of 9, there was a sense that I was being cared for, that something greater than myself was caring for me and in a very intimate way, mm-hmm. and that I might care for others in that same spirit, in that same way. It's where I first learned about caring in the deepest sense.
Interesting. And one aspect of your biography that's particularly unique is the focus on mathematics and then a transition away from that, because often, and this is the assumption, it's not necessarily the case, but often it seems that a pursuit of something as abstract as mathematics takes one away from relationship to other people and is sort of a isolating kind of pursuit. So I'm curious how that arising sense of the importance of service in your teens played with your kind of initial directions towards studying mathematics and computer programming.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I was swept along into a career in mathematics in the same way that many other young people were at the time I grew up. In 1957, Sputnik went off, the first suborbital flight that the Russians put up there, and all of a sudden America, in a space race, was committed to doing the same thing. And what they did, what the powers that be did at that point, was to channel all the relatively and very talented young students at the high school and junior high school level who were good at mathematics into science careers and into math careers. I never asked to do it. I was just reasonably good at mathematics and hence channeled into that. But as fate would have it, I ended up working on the moon landing project and helped the first, played a small role in helping those first astronauts get to the lunar surface in July of 1969. And curiously enough, those first mystical experiences at age 9 had to do with the moon. The moon was my friend. The moon was this very important figure in my psychological and spiritual development. And here I was in my very first job, charged with a role in sending people to that moon. So there was, it turned out, an important connection. But the service aspect didn't come until, I wasn't conscious of it until my teenage years, to some degree, that's where it was born, and then later on much more strongly in my 20s and 30s.
And I saw, and this came up in the biography and some of your material, that even in that work with the moon program and watching how teams of people could work together to accomplish things, that actually formed kind of a practical impression for you that later you translated into applying that in a life of service.
That's exactly right. I was when I worked at the on the moon landing project, I was much more interested in the people than I was in the science. I was absolutely enthralled by the notion that I saw around me on Apollo 11, which is tens of thousands of people, not that I knew them all, but I knew the ones in proximity to my workstation who were doing the best work of their lives. They were doing incredible work because they were so motivated by the moon landing project. And these were people who perhaps had not, in many instances, done their best work on any project in their entire lives, but now they were involved in an activity that really drew the best out of them. And that's where that interest in high performance came from. That there was a compelling mission that can spur all of us to much greater growth personally than we ever knew possible.
That sounds intoxicating. So, and certainly inspiring. So, just in your personal biography, I assume you're probably in your 20s at the time you were having those early 20s, perhaps with that experience with the. This vast team all working so effectively in support of this project to put human bodies on the moon and return them safely.
Yeah, that's right. I was in my 20s. In fact, I was 24 years old working on the moon landing project and absolutely amazed at what I was seeing around me in terms of the enthusiasm of the people involved. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a family where my father and grandfather did not really enjoy their jobs very much. They worked to support their families, but they would never have said that they loved their work. Mm-hmm. And here I was surrounded by people who adored what they were doing because of the grandeur of it.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel? I mean, you've already said that you were more excited about the aspect of being with these other people. But how did you find the work itself? Were you drawn into that?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. The mission itself was as compelling for me as it was for the others. It was an amazing mission. The actual activities that many of us did, certainly that I did on a daily basis, were extraordinarily boring. People think that just because you're working on a project, the sum total of which is amazing, mm-hmm. that perhaps the daily life that contributes to such a project is amazing, but a lot of it was boring beyond belief, but I endured because of the mission, put it that way.
Got it. And so I take it then from the biography that Stuart was just reading earlier that that would have been at least some of the reason for your decision to move towards psychology.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. I realized that my future had to be in an understanding of human beings and their potential for growth and development at the farther reaches of their capability. And it was not going to be, my future was not going to be in science and math.
Got it. Was there any particular When you went into psychology, was there any particular school of psychology, any particular teacher? I mean, I notice you are associated with the Jung Institute, and I'm just wondering what strains of psychology did you find intriguing?
The person who spoke to me loudest in those early days was Abraham Maslow, and he is somebody who should not be forgotten because he wrote some incredibly important stuff. He tends to be remembered for only two or three things, but he developed a body of work that really is impressive and motivated me enormously. I then discovered Jung later on, and he's somebody who's not likely to be forgotten, although he's hardly recognized within the greater boundaries of psychology as a contributor. He's seen more on the periphery of it all, which is a bit of a shame, more than a bit of a shame. But I was absolutely enthralled by Jungian thought in my graduate years also.
I'm interested during this period of time that did you find the Western psychological model answering that need that drew you toward it? And I say that from the perspective of today because certainly on this show we explored a great deal the kind of the modern linking of psychology and spiritual practices, particularly Buddhist psychology. And I know that you give nods to Buddhism, but it's not clear from that early part of your biography if a formalized spiritual practice or recognition was really present for you, or you were working within the confines of Western psychology.
Well, put it this way, it was a bit of both. I started at Berkeley, a PhD program in clinical psychology that I enjoyed enormously and benefited from enormously, but I realized that it did not go all the way, that in fact there was no mention of spiritual development. There was no room for spiritual development within mainstream psychology at that point, except for some fringe, and I say this with great affection because the people involved ended up being friends, except for movements like transpersonal psychology and to some degree humanistic psychology, although mostly transpersonal psychology. I was essentially studying the Eastern religions first in a general sense, and then I spent 2 years studying Tibetan Buddhism. I spent a great deal of time in Buddhist meditation practice over a period of years, trying out different things. I wouldn't be somebody who you could call an adherent of one particular perspective over a very long period of time. I'm much too curious to do that. But I spent a great deal of time studying a number of different traditions to try to see what contributions to my development and to my understanding of human development in general might come from such inquiry.
And do you find that you're at that kind of phase in your life, was this evolving recognition of the centrality of service to your life's work something that was coming from within more, or was it something that you were being inspired from let's say, the conversation in some of these spiritual sources?
I think it was both. I've always been very drawn to situations in which people were suffering and had no way out, were marginalized by society, who seemed to be captives of a certain kind of life that necessitated, it seemed for them, a great deal of suffering. I've always been drawn to assist in any way I can in those situations. But the other half of that equation, that it was a wonderful question you asked, central to all of the spiritual traditions that I studied was the notion of service. Despite what the differences were, if you take a look at Christianity, you take a look at Judaism, take a look at Buddhism or Sufism or Hinduism or any of the other traditions that any of us might investigate, service is central. There's a central component having to do with serving those in need. So my intuition that drew me to those who were hurting was confirmed by every one of the traditions I investigated.
Yeah, and I saw something that you had written in one of the pieces on the Shanti site where you described this pivotal winter solstice night that you spent after sitting with a patient who had been struggling with Guillain-Barré syndrome. And what you wrote was, "Your old beliefs about my relationships, my work, and myself would soon be challenged and in time would die. New beliefs, healthier ones, would replace them. I had discovered that service, not success, is the ultimate organizing principle of a life well lived, the sine qua non of the spiritual life, the moral life, the contented life." And I'd like you to elaborate on that, because it's to me, a very powerful sort of crystallizing realization, and not one that's always so clearly understood in the modern spiritual world, when often accomplishment and sort of success in various spiritual forms are the things that are emphasized.
Well, the modern spiritual world is influenced by the modern world in general.
Yeah.
And the modern world in general is absolutely obsessed with notions of achievement. In fact, my trilogy on peak performance was an attempt to understand what motivated our highest achievers really. I wanted to see if it was this self-serving notion that I had to improve myself and my success, my stature, my place in the world. I wanted to see if that were true, and it turned out that it was not nearly as true as the common knowledge would indicate. But that particular vignette that you, or case example, if you want to call it that, of that Christmas night in 1973 when I just finished caring for a man who was really suffering, who was essentially paralyzed and might never get out of it, I realized that that context, that situation, and others like it motivated me much more strongly than any self-serving drive towards success, and that if I was going to have a contented life, a life that made sense in the broadest way, that central to that life had to be serving other human beings rather than doing things that allowed me greater and greater success. You're absolutely right in what you said. I wanted to highlight it very boldly when you said that in the spiritual community, that distinction between a focus on personal success and a focus on service is not understood. It's sometimes quite misunderstood. I've worked for over 40 years with people at the end of life. And the people at the end of life only talk about two things. If you want to take this as a poignant moment in the life trajectory, when people are asked about their memories, when they reflect on their life, they talk about two essential topics: people they loved and who loved them, the love in their life, and the work that they were proud of, work that made a contribution, work in essence, work that was service work. Not one person at the end of life, after all of these years of sitting at bedsides, ever looked at me and started rattling off their bio. You know, people don't talk about achievements except insofar as the achievement might be a contribution to the welfare of others.
Got it. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I are speaking this week with our guest by telephone, Dr. Charles Garfield. Charles Garfield, Ph.D., is the founder of Shanti and Shanti National Training Institute. He is a clinical professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California Medical School and a former board member of the C.G. Jung Institute in San Francisco. He's published 10 books, including Sometimes My Heart Goes Numb, Love and Caring in a Time of AIDS, Psychosocial Care of the Dying Patient, and Stress and Survival, The Emotional Realities of Life-Threatening Illness.
So I want to draw out further this point about the centrality of service as part of the spiritual enterprise, because I think when most people think of spiritual practice, if they even would use that phrase or term, they are imagining meditation or they're imagining prayer, or they're imagining, I don't know, martial arts even, or yoga, or something like that. Something like that, that does not necessarily, it may, but does not necessarily have a component that exceeds the boundaries of the individual person, at least as they conceive themselves to be. So I'm wondering if you can talk more about the experiences that you were having as you said you were exploring various traditions and mentioned that you studied Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, for a couple of years. Can you talk about what you were doing when you were doing that? What practices were you doing, and what that revealed to you?
Well, I could talk about meditation practice, because during those years, the formative years in particular, meditation practice was important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But in retrospect, I think what was even more important was the realization that my spiritual life was intimately bound to my relationship life,
mm-hmm.
that I was connected not only to other people, but to all living beings. More of a what one might call an ecological sense in the current day.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the West in particular, and it took years to figure this out and to really get a visceral sense of it, but in the West in particular, to ignore relationships as our essential, as part of our essential practice, is to ignore something enormous. I think any spiritual practice which doesn't include one's relationship life leaves out an important activity, an important aspect of who we are as human beings. So my meditation practice in those formative years, and still, is intimately linked to the quality of my connection, let's call it, to other human beings, but it's even greater than that. It has to do with living beings in general.
Mm-hmm.
That when I think of mindfulness practice now, I think of mindfulness as it allows me to be more mindful of my essential connectedness to all life, rather than just being mindful of my own thoughts, for instance, which can be incredibly important. As a psychologist, I can tell you that there's an intimate connection between the individual's capacity to be aware of one's thoughts at deeper and deeper levels and the quality of one's life. But the same is true of one's relationship life, that to the degree that one is more and more mindful of one's connection with other human beings, the quality of that connection, the essential responsibility in the deepest sense that we have for one another, that for me has been the most important awareness all these years.
Got it. Well, there's a couple of things that come up as I reflect on what you've just said, which I think you beautifully expressed. One is that Stuart's and my spiritual practice was something that we learned from our teacher, who explicitly had as one of the two legs of practice. One was an equivalent to a mindfulness practice, although it's from the Gurdjieff tradition, called self-observation meditation. But the other one is called co-meditation, and it's explicitly sitting with another person, establishing eye contact, and putting your full attention on that other person. So I'm very tuned into the sort of point about relationship that you're making. So second thing is and he was our teacher was someone who was aware and quite explicit that for at least for Westerners, people growing up in Western cultures, it's really important not to give short shrift to relationship because of the emphases of our cultural matrix. So I don't know if you want to if there's anything that comes up for you to comment about that. I have a second point, but go ahead if there's anything that arises.
Well, I think what came to me as you were talking was, if you get an image of an Easterner or somebody who's following a Eastern tradition in its essence, you might get the feeling that sitting in a monastery or in a cave somewhere was the optimal context for deepening one's practice.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say in the West is that the optimal context would be relationship life.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That I have nothing against monasteries and nothing against periods of retreat. I've done many myself.
Right.
But more important to me in my spiritual development has been the connection with other human beings, and particularly the service aspect of that connection.
Yeah, that's interesting, because in a sense, what Rob was describing in terms of our own teacher's emphasis on co-meditation practice was a recognition that for many people growing up in Eastern societies, there's much more of an emphasis on relationship as sort of the context in which you grow up, and in some respects, pulling away from that is a balancing, whereas in the West, our emphasis and our context tends to be much more individualism, and we're out, you know, for ourselves, and success is what determines your value. So service is the thing that balances that, or service and relationship with other people, and the focus on that is what actually is the gateway for us to transcend our programming, as it were.
I would agree with that totally, particularly the initiating comment, which had to do with what I think of as radical individualism in the West. You know, if you want to create that balance, as you said, what balances radical individualism? It's deepening connection with others.
That makes a lot of sense. So the other point I was going to make is, it came up. I'm spearheading a project right now called the Festival of Conscious Parenting, going to be happening in Santa Rosa next month, and it's bringing together people from various diverse spiritual and psychological traditions in service of conscious parenting. And there is no definition to conscious parenting. Asking the question of what conscious parenting is the act of defining it moment by moment. But one of the things that has been coming up for me in regard to that is conversation like we're having now, as a method of engagement with another person, and conversation as a metaphor for the process of how relationship works. And that's why I'm very intrigued by your life history and your description of how you moved in the direction that you took in your career. So I wonder if you could start to talk about early experiences that you had being, or what, I guess, since we haven't established this yet for the radio audience, what took you in the direction personally of working with severely ill or dying people?
It was an intuition, like all the intuitions that motivate a life in a positive way. It was an intuition. And I sometimes say it was my one great idea in the shower. I was very aware that what I experienced with that one man who had Guillain-Barré disease and who was paralyzed, what the intimacy, the depth of connection, the fact that there was no other place in the entire world I'd rather be than at his bedside during that period, that in fact there was a way to extend the impact of such a discovery to my entire career, that I might in fact be useful to a whole category of human beings. The question for me, of course, was, well, who? How do I name the category? What was it? And when I did a postdoctoral year at the Cancer Research Institute at the University of California, I found myself the only mental health professional on a 40-bed unit of seriously ill cancer patients, and my job was essentially to be in charge of the psychosocial and spiritual needs of all of those people. Obviously, it's an impossible job with 40 seriously ill people, any one of whom I could have spent an entire day with, given the magnitude of what they were dealing with.
Yeah.
But what I did know was that something in my history allowed me to understand, even though I was only at the time 29 years old, something in my history allowed me to understand some of what they were going through. There was a kind of intimate connection with these folks, even though I had never been with a dying person before. I could see it in their eyes. I could see that, in fact, a kind of deep existential loneliness was the powerful ingredient, and I knew what that felt like. Somehow I had a taste of that earlier in my life, and that, in fact, was true. I learned later and wrote about it under the general heading of the wounded healer that, in fact, my early childhood wounding, such as it was, and I don't mean to overstate it, but, I was in a situation where I was the first child in an extended family, and I was made a big fuss over, and then all of a sudden I had a sickly younger brother who demanded everybody's attention. And I was exiled, so to speak, from my central position and was abandoned, not because anybody really abandoned me, but because a three-year-old feels abandoned when the centrality of his position is swiped so quickly. Well, I noticed that kind of abandonment in the eyes of the people I cared for, and I realized that one person, myself, could make all the difference, that I could be the difference between zero and one, meaning that having one person willing to hold the situation with you can make all the difference, as opposed to having zero, nobody. And that became the intriguing impetus behind not only my career, the portion of my career that had to do with dying people, and it's been constant ever since. But also the part having to do with the founding of Shanti. That's how Shanti started. Also, I realized that I could have other people. I could train volunteers to also be with people at the end of life. And those early volunteers helped me at the Cancer Institute when I couldn't possibly get to 40 people in a day. There was no way, but I could have other people who I trained to sit at those bedsides and be useful.
And so the genesis of Shanti was in the to support the work you were doing in the oncology unit. Is that right?
Exactly.
And you had at that point, you elaborated training and had a volunteer system set up with Shanti in the first few years in that support of that work, right?
I didn't hear.
I said you had a you started to organize the team and have some sense of training for volunteers in that early period.
Yes, what I realized, and the key realization came when I understood that some of what I learned in a marvelous PhD program in clinical psychology at Berkeley, part of it, not all of it, but some key elements of it could be used to train volunteers. That in fact, some of that information could be taught to lay people, could be taught to anyone who was motivated and who was screened well. I could teach effective listening techniques. I could teach referral techniques. I could teach an understanding of family dynamics to some degree. I don't want to overstate this. It's not that you can teach a whole PhD to a layperson, especially quickly, but you can teach some fundamental skills.
I'd, I didn't follow. What is referral? What do you mean by that?
Oh, to know when you're over your head.
Ah.
And to refer to professionals.
Got it.
So I think I saw somewhere in one of the talks that you gave that you listed the kind of the three essentials as the knowledge that love heals, the comfort with not knowing, and the awareness that bearing witness is enough.
That's exactly right. Those three things can and I would say must be taught to anybody who cares to work with people who are suffering.
So how did you come to identify those principles yourself, and then I guess that was part of the recognition of things you could teach, but how did that distillation process happen for you?
It's lovely to have enough time to answer that question. I get asked that one a lot, and often people don't have time to hear the answer.
Got it.
When I was taking care of my father when he was dying, I worked night and day to come up with the latest treatments for liver cancer, which is what he had, and it was essentially supposed to be fatal, and in fact eventually was. But I would talk to him constantly about bucking the odds, about fighting for your life, and he never listened. He never had any connection to what I was saying. And one day, sitting in his house, we were sitting on chairs next to each other, and I was going off again on the necessity for the right attitude and mm-hmm. not only the right treatment. This wasn't a rejection of Western medicine. This was a complementary kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me with this absolutely beatific smile and said, "Charlie, I love you. Nobody in my life before or after has ever said I love you to me with as much poignancy and authenticity as my father did that one afternoon." And I realized in the conversation with him that followed that what I was showing him in caring so much was that I loved him enormously.
Yeah.
And that was much more important than the content of what I was saying to him.
Right. Mm.
So love heals. It doesn't always cure. There's a difference between healing and curing. But love heals. It can heal spiritually. It could heal interpersonally. It can heal emotionally and psychologically. And I would like to think that it was in that awareness that the realization that showing love and being available to another human being in the spirit of love is one of the key ingredients. You know, it's not so different than the Dalai Lama being asked what his religion is, and he says, "My religion is kindness."
Hmm.
Well, this is a corollary of that awareness, that love heals, kindness heals. This basic, deep, transpersonal affection that we can show for one another heals. And whether it ever heals physically is of less interest to me, even though I would love for that to happen at times, than the fact that it heals emotionally and spiritually and psychologically.
And one question I have about that, because I think it speaks to how people who aren't as grounded in this work sometimes come to end-of-life situations, is when you write that the awareness of bearing witness is enough, sort of embodied in bearing witness is a profound love.
Absolutely.
A profound love of being present with someone. But often what's embodied in trying to tell someone it's going to be all right, or, you know, don't worry, you're going to get better and things like that, is more of an impulse to avoid what really is happening.
That's quite true. And in the willingness to bear witness, to hold the situation with the other person, even when you can't do anything and you can't change it and you wish you could and you wish the suffering would diminish, that what you can do is hold that situation. It's like the poet says, "They also serve who only stand and wait." That in fact, to be there, to hold a hand, to cry with another person, to laugh with another person, to be there most fully in interpersonal connection. What Thich Nhat Hanh refers to, the great Buddhist teacher, refers to as interbeing. And even the psychology, mainstream psychology, has talked a lot about what's called intersubjectivity. It's the same thing. It's saying to the other person, by virtue of your presence, I am with you. I am here. I am here as far as I can go on this journey, and then the rest of it is up to you.
And I guess the comfort with not knowing is really about recognizing that you don't have to do everything and you don't have to control the situation.
You can't. That the realization that you can't control the situation, that none of us can deal with these situations in a way that implies mastery. This is not about mastery, except in the West, mastery is the religion. And so,
that's succinctly put.
You know, you're essentially saying to people who bow at the deity of mastery, you're essentially saying your primary orientation to everything you do doesn't work. You better find another one. And the other one is compassionate presence. You know, in Buddhism, the two wings of the bird, compassion and wisdom.
Right. And in fact, Buddhism has a fairly elaborated set of practices. I believe it's the metta meditations that train one, actually, to move one's attention in that direction.
Absolutely. Loving kindness. The metta meditations. Then, you know, to deepen and deepen and deepen one's capacity for loving kindness.
So do you find with... when volunteers come to Shanti, are they already drawn by this kind of inspiration, and it's just a matter of basically giving some guidelines and a context in which they can practice? Or do you find that some volunteers come with really not with kind of from the more westernized viewpoint, and it's a bit of a shock, if not a positive shock, but a shock to their psycho-spiritual system to suddenly be confronted with the reality of end-of-life situations?
Well, I think it's at least a tad intimidating to all sorts of people, especially when you realize that whatever skills you have are only partially effective in this situation, because a lot of the young volunteers, a lot of the volunteers are very young. And, you know, I speak at all the trainings still after 40 years. Shanti's 40 years old this year, and I speak at all the trainings four times a year. And I'm looking out at a group of young people, many of whom are in their 20s and 30s, and probably more in their 20s than any other single cohort group. And they want very badly to have skills. They want skills. We're obsessed with skills because skills contribute to mastery, and mastery is the central religion. And what I'm effectively saying to them when I get my message across best is that although you will learn some skills that are useful to you on how to listen more effectively and how to understand relationships, the dying person's relationships with significant people in their lives, although you'll get some skills that matter, your presence, your loving presence, is the most important thing you bring to the situation, and it can be a challenge for some people. But I also say that I look out at the group of people and I say, and what I'd say to anybody listening to this program, you've been there before if you've ever cared for any being, and if you've never cared for a dying person, you might have cared for a pet. You might have, and I guess pet is not a PC word anymore, an animal companion. that in fact, if you've cared for any living being, in your life, then you know what it feels like, and that's all we're asking. We're asking you to care deeply for the people that you're assigned to, and learn to build that relationship over time in a way that's effective, especially for the recipient of service.
I'm interested in one of the descriptions I came across in my background research was a comment about some of the experience that people have had in either dying situations or just very serious illness situations, that even the nurses, who we often associate with that role in society, are so overworked and have so many things to do that their relationship with a patient becomes sort of very objectified.
It becomes very objectified, and it's not because these are not good people. You know, the nurses I've known for decades have overwhelmingly been supportive, loving people without the opportunity to express that love and capacity for connection because of the work context that they're in.
Right. Yeah, we have a friend who works as a medical assistant in a nursing home, and if he spends too much time with a patient, because that's just being with the patient, then usually spells trouble at the end of the shift because a set of things on the checklist weren't done.
That's a very familiar state of affairs, and it's one of the greatest stresses on nurses in particular, but also physicians, mental health professionals, other people who work in the larger healthcare system, are stressed beyond belief, not only by having too much work to do, but not being able to do their best work and knowing it.
Yeah, that's right. We actually, Stuart's sister is now a palliative care specialist.
Uh-huh.
But for years she was in a head trauma ICU as a nurse, and ended up, she had I guess you would call it an intuitive grasp of how to be authentic with both patients and family, but it was such a rare occasion for her to have space to do that as effectively as she might have. So just in the last few years, she's found she's found this new job in palliative care, and it allows her more scope than she previously had to offer that sort of guidance and presence that you were talking about.
I've heard that story or versions of it so many times, where nurses whose primary stress, when you ask them, is not only about having too much work to do, but as I said a little bit ago, not being able to do the work at as deep a level and as authentically as they would like. So they go into palliative care, like the situation you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
or they go back to school and become counselors or therapists or mm-hmm. teachers, something that will allow them a context in which they can be their best selves more consistently.
Got it. Well, we need to take a short break at the hour. The time is 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS LP Cows Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I are speaking this week with our guest by telephone, Dr. Charles Garfield. Charles Garfield, Ph.D., is founder of Shanti and Shanti National Training Institute. He is a clinical professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California Medical School and a former board member at the C.G. Jung Institute in San Francisco. He has published 10 books, including Sometimes My Heart Goes Numb, Love and Caregiving in a Time of AIDS, Psychosocial Care of the Dying Patient, and Stress and Survival, The Emotional Realities of Life-Threatening Illness. eScript is an easy way to support Cal's Radio. Donate at no cost through eScript shopping. Here's how it works. Sign up online with your ATM or credit card and choose Cal's Radio as the recipient. Once you sign up to 5% of your purchases at stores who honor eScript purchases will automatically go to your designated nonprofit organization through your credit card or ATM card. Go to www.escrip.com to find participating businesses in your area.
for eScript to grow in your community, simply ask your favorite businesses if they are signed up with eScript. Chaos Community Radio wishes to thank the Occidental Community Council for their generous support. The Occidental Community Council strives to meet the unmet needs of the Occidental area. The Council invites you to attend its meetings every third Saturday of the month at 10:30 a.m. at the YMCA Community Center. The Festival of Conscious Parenting is coming up June 20th through 22nd, 2004 in the Santa Rosa area. Imagine a world where adults share the awareness practices of the world's spiritual traditions in order to create wise, nurturing, loving contexts for children and youth. Powerful resources to deepen and expand consciousness exist in every spiritual religious tradition. The Festival of Conscious Parenting is a forum to share those resources to support children growing up healthy, resilient, and whole. Adopting spiritual awareness practices to consciously serve the needs of children furthers, deepens, and expands adult consciousness. So the festival will be taking place June 20th through 22nd. On Friday, there'll be a free evening presentation with pioneers who have decades of experience in the work of conscious parenting. That will be at the Glaser Center in Santa Rosa. And then on Saturday, there'll be a day-long focus with adults, talks and panels in the morning, and breakout groups in the afternoon to discuss specific issues, techniques, and ways to bring the inspiration of conscious parenting to the nitty-gritty realities of daily lives. That will be at the Sonoma Country Day School in Santa Rosa. And then on Sunday, there'll be a half day that's fun for the family. Kids and adults both will be participating, and it'll include community rituals, entertainment that will appeal to all, and breakout groups with activities appropriate to children, youth, and family. So, if you're interested in this, you can find out about how to join the Festival of Conscious Parenting. The website is www.tfocp.org. The phone number is area code 707-836-3270. This is sponsored by Taiyu Meditation Center and the Hearth Foundation. We'll return to our conversation with Charles Garfield after a short musical break. During the break, you'll be listening to a track called Using the Apostate Tyrant as His Tool by Cassia, arranged by Diane Touliatos. This is from the CD Kronos Quartet Early Music.